listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Earlier this month, on October 1st, China celebrated the 69th anniversary of its successful revolution. That was approximately 28 years after the founding of the Communist Party of China, and a struggle that began in 1921 that still continues in some ways today. China is the world's most populous nation, has by some measures the world's largest or second largest economy, and is still undergoing a process of rapid development. For more on that, we're speaking with Professor Luciana Bone via telephone from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Don. Yes, we're going to talk about China. Perhaps start with the views that are given to us in, let's call it the West, on China. And let's start with the so-called alleged religious persecution in Xinjiang. Which the Western media has been full of since March of this year, intensifying in July, August, September, and going on now. But is China exercising religious persecution in Xinjiang or social progress? You and I have gone over this. While discussing the 1930s in Russia, where, you know, the terror, the great terror, the purges, that's what Russia was being portrayed of. And at the same time, the Stalin was building schools, hospitals, etc. So, you know, to say the least, the point of view is one-sided. Anyway, so it seems that the Western media is launching what I call the terrorism of indignation. It, right. it's, it's media terrorism, and it's trying to elicit outrage and indignation in the humanitarian West. And the Atlantic Monthly came out, I think it was in June or July, saying China holds a million Uyghurs Muslims in camps. And it quotes the UN, special some organization of human rights. So, you know, I mean, I put this sentence in Google, in the Google search engine this morning, and I wrote, China is not persecuting Uyghur population. And you know what I got? An avalanche of articles on China's persecution of Uyghur population, from WAPO to New York Times, from Breitbart to The Guardian, from Radio Free Asia to Foreign Policy, from the National Review to the UN Human Rights Chief, not the Council, the Chief. In other words, from extreme right, so-called, to lefty left, all crying humanitarian crisis in Xinjiang. Of course, we'll just say that Xinjiang is rich in oil. It's rich in oil, and it's likely to be scheduled to be the hubbub of the rail initiative, the Silk Road.
The Belt and Road Initiative.
I mean, it's a key point, as crucial as Afghanistan, on the initiative, on the BRI initiative, and also it's got oil. Now, what this media is doing is the same thing that they did with Yugoslavia, particularly Kosovo. You know, raise an ethnic, raise the flag of humanitarian rescue for a persecuted minority.
Right, so ethnic and religious, with an ethnic and a religious dimension to it. I mean, we saw this, you know, they did it with the Dalai Lama with China back in the 1950s, you know, with the Tibetans. And they always had the left, quote unquote, people here that were concerned about China's treatment of the Tibetans without any acknowledgement that they were defending a medieval cult, basically. And also even the same game was played with the Warsaw Pact countries in the Soviet Union, Mindszenty and the Catholic Church, and some of the prelates of the Orthodox Church inside Russia. And the game that's being played now with Ukraine, with the Ukrainian church. This is part of the CIA's playbook, is to play this stuff.
The religious card,
The way they pronounce it at Wikipedia is Uyghurs, but I've heard Uyghurs and others, and I don't know in the native language, but it's a Turkic ethnic group, just for people who don't know. They live elsewhere also in East and Central Asia. We're talking about in Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China, where they're one of 55 officially recognized ethnic minorities, and they primarily practice Islam, those that practice religion. They're genetically related, according to Wikipedia, to both Caucasoid, sounds like a word my old nun used to use, and East Asian populations. And so, well, you know, we're talking about a Turkish ethnic group that lives in Western China that has historical links, if not practicing Islam, and they're being targeted essentially by Western propaganda to cause dissension in the Western part of China.
Being used. I say Uyghurs simply because it sounds to me like Hungarian.
And it may well be because they're related.
But they are a Turkic group, yes. But anyway, the National Review has had a coverage of that. And it said, ethnic cleansing makes a comeback in China. The Washington Post. Beijing crackdown, Uyghur minority is setting a new standard for oppression. The Chinese government persecution of innocents continues. The horror in Xinjiang, etc. This is, I think, the Washington Post. Then we have Al Jazeera, Qatar,
Yes.
They describe a 5-meter-high fence with barbed wire kept the camp secure because, you know, there are 10 million Uyghurs in re-education camps, which has an echo to the Cultural Revolution and what went on in Cambodia under Pol Pot.
Yep.
There's echoes, you know, of former scams. Propaganda scam.
Right.
5-meter high fence, barbed wire, secures the camp out of public view. Outside, a sign reads, "No communist, no China." And that's Al Jazeera.
Right.
Were people destroyed, cries the Guardian on their behalf. Of course, Radio Free Asia, which is funded by the U.S. government,
right,
says that it's arguably among the worst, if not the most severe, since the Cultural Revolution. And Forbes says growing religious persecution in China is a symptom of Xi's concentration of power. And let's see, let me skip a bit here. I have quite a number. Islamic leaders have nothing good to say about China's internment of Uyghurs, says Foreign Policy. The human rights chief blasts China for persecuting Muslims in Xinjiang, so on and so forth. But finally, let me see. One is the New York Times. The New York Times says, "What is Trump going to do about the horror in Xinjiang?"
Mm.
And now, Freedom House, which we know also is attached to the intelligence services, the secret services, the phony foundation,
right,
or the real foundation that propagate propaganda.
Right.
It says in its executive summary of 2018, it says that at the CCP's 19th Congress in October 2017, and I quote them, a plan for comprehensive management of all religious activity and organizations and a Sinicization of religion in China laid out at an April party conference further restricted the scope for religious freedom. The government continued to impose conditions approaching martial law in Tibetan and Uyghur populated region of the country. So what is this Sinicization? It's the bringing under government control the appointment of the bureaucracy of churches. We have seen that China has just signed a contract, an agreement, understanding that the Vatican, a foreign power, cannot just appoint bishops without the vetting of the central powers, the Communist Party. And the Vatican agreed, and the bishop that has been appointed is somebody approved by the Communist Party. They don't want to have a Mezaros, or whatever the heck his name was in Hungary, or a Stepinac that was in Croatia, gathering dissent while pretending to tending the flock,
right,
against the government. So Sinicization of religion is simply a provision, not simply, I think it's a provision to control foreign penetration, which we know China suffered greatly from the missionary invasion that it had in its 100 years of humiliation. So this is just a formalization of who rules China.
Right. That's right. I mean, you know, if you take a look at the role that religion was used to play in taking down the Eastern European states, if folks don't remember, absolutely, you know, there was the whole...
Starting with Poland.
Yeah, in Poland you had the workers' uprising, quote-unquote, at Gdansk and the other places, Lech Walesa, the shipyards, all of that, supposedly showing labor's resistance to socialism. And at the very moment that this was, you know, addressed and started to dissipate, suddenly the first Polish pope in human history finds his way to the Vatican, leaping over bodies of Italians in every direction. And suddenly Polish Catholicism, you know, rises for the first time in 1,000 years. And now people are going to church to organize against the state, in essence, which is what happened. Which made me nervous when we saw an Argentinian pope after the last successful CELAC conference. I was a little suspicious about that, but right. This is what they do. You had during Hungary in 1956, Mindszenty. There was a Catholic priest in China that was a cause célèbre for the CIA and others as a rallying point of good Christians around the world against the evil commies in Beijing. This is the game they play.
Yeah, sure. We saw the role of the Vatican in the rise of the Nazis. The role, you know, the or in Italy, the agreement between Mussolini and the Pope. In
right.
Spain,
yep.
I mean, the Catholic Church, I don't mean the observant people, the poor people that go to church and whatever.
Right.
That's fine. No, this has to do with power and bureaucracy and control and money and real power to buy arms, to fund exiles, Nazi exiles, etc. But the Chinese media this summer counterattacked, and Global Times is government media, Chinese government media, but it answered the attacks, and they said that were mounting. And they said the Chinese ethnic and religious policies in Xinjiang and for the Uyghurs autonomous region have given priority to anti-secession and counter-terrorism so as to maintain stable development. And Western media should see the situation themselves before accusing China, says the Global Times. And they quote I don't know if it's a woman or McDougall, a member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, who said he was the author, or she was the author of the whole, the 10 million in re-education camp to which the Western media latched on. So they said, the Global Times said, the UN spokesperson said that Uyghurs and Muslim minorities were forced into political camps for indoctrination in northwest China, Xinjiang, Uyghur region. And the BBC reported this, they say. But Chinese experts on Monday, that is, the report came out on a Friday, it doesn't matter. It was noted by the Chinese observers that previous terrorist activity in Xinjiang cost too much, and anti-secession and counter-terrorism efforts in ethnic minority region, especially in Xinjiang, have enhanced the security and eliminated terror threats in the region. In other words, what did we do? We went to war on terror, right? because of 9/11. Now, China is not allowed to have any policies that contains this phenomenon. So it is pointing out, somebody teaching at the Tibet University in Lhasa said, anti-secession and counter-terrorism efforts should and have to be a priority in Xinjiang. And the Tibet Autonomous Region, social development will suffer if the three evil forces, terrorism, separatism, and extremism, prevail in these regions. Of course, they don't say that terrorism, separatism, and extremism are funded and trained and infiltrated by the West, but we all know that's the case. It's practically an invasion by proxy and a destabilization. So, but in effect, what exactly, what is the actual material situation in Xinjiang? The Chinese government listens to local government leaders in ethnic minority regions because they say they attach great importance to poverty alleviation, which could help eliminate extremism. So civil servants in Xinjiang have been sent to remote villages to promote poverty alleviation and to conduct poverty alleviation work and improve the ties with local ethnic residents. So more than 600,000 people in Xinjiang were lifted out of poverty in 2016. The central government and Xinjiang's regional government set a 14.1 billion yuan poverty alleviation and allocated 1.6 billion yuan to relocate residents of poverty-stricken areas. They have been promoting economic development and improving people's living standards. For example, according to data from the National Bureau of Statistics, the Global Times says, the average income of Chinese urban residents in 2017 was 36,396 yuan. I think it's approximately $4,000. Just let me get back to this.
Go ahead. Because this is interesting.
Income thing, which I botched. In 2017, urban residents in Xinjiang earned an average of 30,775 yuan, that is 4,473 dollars a year, while rural residents earned 11,045 yuan, so quite a third less. But that was an increase of 7.8% for the urban population and 8% for the rural population compared to the previous year, you see. So, the average for the urban residents in 2017, I'm not very good with numbers. The average income of Chinese urban residents overall in 2017 was 36,000 yuan, while I said 30,775 in Xinjiang. So Xinjiang has not been left far behind and is getting close to the urban centers in the rest of China. So, you know, while the West is crying, these poor Uyghurs are being put into re-education camp, 10 million of them, and surrounded by fences, and you're either a communist or you're not Chinese, etc. Right. What the material condition are these. Continuous improvement and a pitch for for removing the poverty that allows the extremist propaganda to penetrate. So, you know, the Global Times quotes officials in Yining saying, as a public servant working at the grassroots level, I have witnessed the rapid economic development of Xinjiang and its ethnic unity. But economic development under the leadership of a socialist, of a communist party, the road to socialism, is not something that the West is going to advertise. It's not in their interest.
Of course not.
So,
I mean, look, this is one of the things that we hear about all the time. It's a, you know, point of discussion, you know, ongoing discussion among people that call themselves socialists and communists and of the left here in the United States, with some raising the question. I mean, this is the same thing we heard about the Soviet Union. Is it really a socialist, or is it state capitalist, or is it, you know, something else? It's imperialist, you know, all these different things. And people threw jargon around as if it wasn't supposed to describe some material thing. And, you know, the evidence of the Soviet Union being an imperialist country, for example, which was bandied about for decades by members of the left, quote unquote, here. You know, the first real evidence they had of it was Afghanistan. And in fact, Afghanistan was nothing of the kind. It was reluctantly, the Soviet Union was reluctantly badgered into coming in to Afghanistan to save the government there from its own errors that were taken against the advice of the Soviet government. And so, you know, yet the left here, it's imperialist. The same with China now. China's a capitalist country. China's not a socialist economy. China, you know, neglecting to even say, well, even if China's a capitalist economy, which I don't consider it to be, but for whatever that's worth, it happens to be, you know, the capitalist economy with by far the largest public sector on the planet. And, you know, when people are speaking longingly of Norway, you know, or whatever, for, you know, having free tuition or something, take a look at how China's economy relates to China's workers, and then tell us where socialism exists on planet Earth right now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I posted on China recently, and I called the Western left dimmer than a moonless night because, because, look, let's go over what imperialism means,
right,
and for the umpteenth time.
Right.
So, what is imperialism? Well, we know that China is a big economic power. But we will say that it is neither an empire nor imperialist. People define imperialism in China by the exploitation of wage labor. But that will make the corner grocery store employing one, you know, some students, imperialist.
That imperialist deli up on the corner, the imperialist restaurant down the street.
Yeah, that's right.
Imperialist laundromat and bar, right, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Forgetting, you know, that the accumulation of capital that China has done is it's popular ownership. It's
right.
The people's ownership. It's
exactly.
Their till. People in the West think individually. And you know, if I am, my needs are not attended to, if I'm being exploited, even if that money that I'm exploited by, you know, 10 years ago, has gone in a till that's given me cleaning, schools and stuff for my children. Another thing that the West doesn't think about anymore is the future generations. And China does think of the future generation. So, I mean, in reality, and even if you look at Russia and Western Eastern and its sphere of influence in Eastern in Eastern Europe, how much did it cost to keep this so-called empire? And we also know that the central government of the Soviet Union developed the former colonies of the Tsar. It spent money. It didn't extract money.
Right,
so a better
right.
definition is that imperialism is an extension of class exploitation
across,
by violence
right.
assumed under the agency of the nation state. It's
right.
an extension of class exploitation, extension abroad of class exploitation by the state, which represent the bourgeois class.
We heard in the background the sound of the running dogs of imperialism, but the the point is that
right,
the point is that you have this essentially an international structure that reproduces the class structure of the dominant nation states.
The nation state.
And if you look to the history of this, the more powerful nation states that were also the most stratified coming out of the Middle Ages into the Industrial Age, in Northern Europe, in particular in the UK and Spain and Portugal and Italy, they were the ones, Dutch, they went around and found colonies and started sucking resources back to the motherland. The upper classes in those countries became the most wealthy upper classes in the world. And the capital that they accumulated still remains accumulated with everything that's been accumulated since, and it remains intact. It's just been handed from one member of the elite to another. And it's kind of the thing we should be targeting now for redistribution to the people. We'll get to this next week because I want to explore the history of China more. We got about halfway through it. And we really appreciate your time, Luciana. And we'll speak again next week.
Okay, thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie and Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. There seems to be no end to American involvement in the Middle East. But is Washington still as powerful a player there as it wants to be? Well, today I talked to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Donald Trump's White House is taking a tough stance on Iran. His powerful advisors are threatening drastic American action against Tehran, but with the American troops spread thin across the world and local powers coming together to decide the fate of their region, can Washington hope to continue dictating the future of the Middle East? Will the militant posturing of the White House lead to any real trouble, and can it handle yet another unpredictable conflict?
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us again. So lately, all the important things in Syria are being decided in Ankara, Moscow, and Tehran. The U.S., which once was keen to intervene, is mostly just watching the show right now. Is the current White House more cautious than the previous one or just less powerful?
I think both White Houses, Obama's and Trump's, have been, with regard to Syria in particular, cautious. I think they're still being cautious in the Trump administration, but I would remind you that there are some 12 installations, if you will, that are U.S. installations in Syria, and that there is no intention to move those elements out of Syria until, as one individual from the Pentagon put it, all Iranian elements are out of Syria. And he added parenthetically, and ISIS and other elements like ISIS are thoroughly defeated. So that tells me that regardless of what President Trump might want to have as a policy, which I think is to eventually leave Syria substantially, we are there. We are very much there.
Can we talk more about that? What is the current American goal in Syria? Because under Obama, it did seem like America didn't quite know what it wanted to do exactly. Does Trump know what he wants there?
That's a good question. It's a question I ask my students about everything from U.S.-Russia policy to U.S. policy with regard to Venezuela. No one knows, and this is the mystery of this administration. It's a conundrum. what Trump's policy is from Monday to Tuesday to the end of the week. So it's very difficult, other than listening to strident voices like those of John Bolton, a neoconservative nutcase in my view, or Mike Pompeo, who's not far from that definition, some other spokesperson for the administration, the only sane and sober one being, in my estimation, Jim Mattis at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense, of course. With regard to Syria, though, I think President Obama's strategy, and I actually had occasion to talk to President Obama in the Roosevelt Room in November of 2015 and got some inkling of this, was to admit that Bashar al-Assad was there, that essentially we had made a strategic error in interpreting his role in Syria like we had interpreted Mubarak's role in Egypt. And that was wrong, because there was a sizable portion, powerful portion of the Syrian people that supported Assad, not to mention his armed forces in majority. And so President Obama's policy at that point was sort of patience to see how long it would take to restore Assad, and if eventually the United States could support that. I don't know what Donald Trump's policy is, but it looks at times like a continuation of that policy with some different ingredients, largely manufactured by outside players like Erdogan in Turkey, Putin in Moscow, and to a certain extent, the Ayatollah and President Rouhani in Tehran. And interestingly, the most insidious influence in the whole business, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia.
But how is what you're saying go along with the airstrikes under Trump administration in Syria?
Well, the airstrikes are essentially designed for tactical purposes, I think. I don't see much strategy associated with them. Maybe you could say that they do operate tactically under this kind of strategic umbrella I just defined roughly. But the strikes are to do tactical things like protect the YPG forces, who've been our most stalwart ally in Syria, to protect Kurds in general, who've been our allies throughout the region, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and to more or less eliminate those elements that we thought were associated directly with or were Islamic State terrorists. Now, I realize that the incompetence of our intelligence agency, the CIA, the incompetence of some members of the Pentagon in terms of coordinating these actions have looked rather ambiguous and even stupid to the rest of the world when we found ourselves, for example, with the CIA on one side and the military on the other side, and neither of them able to sort through the various groupings in Syria and decide which was al-Qaeda, which was al-Qaeda affiliated, which was ISIS, and which was genuine freedom fighters, if you will. And I'm not at all sure there are any of those in Syria.
Right, but I really...
It was a hard sorting.
But I really meant airstrikes on Assad, not on ISIS.
Well, I don't know that we've been conducting airstrikes on Assad's forces, such as they are regular forces.
Right, well, that happened twice.
If we have, I think... Yeah, well, I think it's been accidental. The deconfliction between Russian air power, U.S. air power, Syrian air power has been quite good. The cooperation between Russia, Syria, and the United States has been quite good at the tactical level. And that's why we haven't seen more of these era bombings or a shoot down of a Russian plane or a U.S. plane or a Syrian plane. The recent shoot down of the Israeli planes, I think Vladimir Putin has explained quite well for my military attitude. I think the Israeli planes were hiding behind the Russian plane, and they got shot down as a result by Syrian batteries.
So ISIS was cleared out of its main strongholds relatively quickly once the offensive started, but now the coalition is pounding a small pocket near Deir ez-Zor for months and months with little progress. Can you tell me, as a military man, why has the coalition success been stalled at this point?
I think what we're seeing more so than anywhere is those who have been hustled off, bussed, trucked, bribed to go to Idlib and the surrounding area. That's where the real potency is for this situation right now. And that's where supposedly Erdogan and Putin have worked out a deal. I've yet to see how that's going to manifest itself. But it's a dangerous thing that we're doing there, because there are quite a few fighters who are battle-tested and who, if we don't take care of them in one way or another, are going to move off somewhere else and constitute a terrorist threat wherever they do move to, whether it's Turkey, back to China, somewhere in the region, back to the United States, back to Europe, or whatever. So that's the group that I'm worried about, and I think I'm pretty sure that I'm right when I say that's the group the Pentagon is worried about, too, and I suspect that's the group Assad is also worried about.
Now, the settlement of Assad rebel fight is far, far ahead on the horizon, but the U.S. still has a foot in the game with the Kurdish-led forces. Will Washington try to use its allies in the fight against Assad? I mean, do you think it could come to that?
I think we have made the strategic decision that Assad is a legitimate ruler of Syria and is going to be there for the time being. I think we've made that decision. I think that if we haven't, then we're dumb. That would be a very smart decision to have made, and I think we have made it. Now how that plays out as the United States tries to at least maintain a vestige of influence in Syria is anybody's guess. But as I pointed out, I think the biggest impediment to that being worked out in the benefit of the Syrian people, who I might point out are sick and tired of this war. I mean, I'm getting reports from Damascus and elsewhere from people who are what you might call the cognoscenti, the intelligentsia, the people who are behind Assad, the people who support Syria returning to some sort of peace and stability. And they're sick and tired of this war. They want it over. They wanted it over last week. So that's what we need to shoot for. We need to shoot for empowering these people and, in a sense, empowering the Syrian regime so that it can reestablish control over the state. And we need to get the other elements out, and that includes the Saudis, the Iranians, and everyone else who's messing around in Syria. And the most dangerous element in that regard is those 10,000 or so battle-hardened people who are in Idlib province and right now more or less being protected by Erdogan and the Turkish military.
And then there is the Iran factor. Half a year ago, Trump declared the U.S. troops withdrawal from Syria. But now, John Bolton says that U.S. soldiers will not pull out from Syria until Iran withdraws its forces, like you said. So has the U.S. strategy in Syria officially altered from combating terrorists to countering Iran? Or is this the part of the whole anti-Iran drive?
I think that's part of it. And if you know the neoconservative philosophy, like I know the neoconservative philosophy, you know that their big target is Iran. Their fascination, their fixation is Iran. I think they might be getting ready to be surprised, personally. I'll put my magic hat on and say that I think we're going to have a Singapore moment with regard to Iran, and I think the president is going to turn the tables on John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and the rest of those nutcases in the administration. I think we're going to have an extended invitation to Rouhani, to Zarif, and Trump is going to find a city, Geneva comes to mind, and they're going to sit down, if Rouhani and Zarif will eventually accept. And Trump is going to go to that meeting, and he's going to sit down with these Iranian leaders, and he's then going to say, right before the U.S. midterm elections, so it'll be a November surprise, he's going to say, I have just worked out a deal. It's better than the deal President Obama worked out, and we're going to talk about it further. And he's going to hope that has a really dynamic, positive political impact on the midterm elections, because right now, in this country, it's looking like the Republicans are sure going to lose the House and maybe lose the Senate.
Well, that's one option. But a second option could be like his meeting with Putin in Helsinki, where he was willing to actually make peace. But then the whole American establishment turned so much against him that he can't even breathe towards Russia anymore. So that could actually worsen
the American establishment.
His relations with Iran even more if he goes to the meeting.
The establishment is not against peace. The establishment is not against peace. Who's against peace are the neoconservatives in the establishment. So standing up to the neoconservatives, President Trump would have no problem telling John Bolton to walk out the door and getting a fourth national security advisor. There's no doubt in my mind he'd tell John Bolton to walk out the door. For that matter, anybody else in the administration too. In that respect, that's a strength of this president, and God knows there are few strengths of this president, but that is one. So I have no problem envisioning him telling the neoconservatives to take a hike. The president might be besieged and in political peril, but he's still not a dumb man.
All right, Colonel, on that note, we're going to take a short break right now. We're talking to Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, talking about America's confrontation with Iran and its implications for the whole Middle East. Stay with us.
Listening to Weekday World on CPR.
We're back with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, discussing the U.S. policy in the Middle East. So, Colonel, before America went to war in Iraq, Bush spent 2 years trying to make us believe Saddam was in bed with Osama bin Laden. Right now, there is no PR campaign of this magnitude going on. So war isn't really that likely?
Well, I beg to differ with you slightly. I agree that it's not quite the momentum that it had in 2002 and early 2003, especially the momentous event of Colin Powell going to the United Nations Security Council. But there is a campaign going on, and it's being led from the outside by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Mark Dubowitz, John Hanna, and others at that group, who are essentially working for the United Arab Emirates and Israel in trying to foment the war, or at least military action against, or at the very best, regime change, effective, immediate regime change in Tehran. And their campaign is pretty relentless. If you're back here reading the internet, reading other things than the New York Times and the Washington Post, which I don't even bother to read anymore, you understand this campaign is fairly effective. And as I said, it's on behalf of the UAE and on behalf of Israel. You even have people meeting with this ambassador from the UAE, Otaibi, in Washington and talking about things like the UAE taking over Al Udeid Air Base, which is, as you know, probably in the region and the largest U.S. Air Force base probably in the world. So there are machinations going on right now in Washington beneath the stage, if you will. And these are aimed at bringing about regime change in Iran. And frankly, these people don't care how it happens. Military action, a combination of military and economic action or whatever, they just want regime change in Iran.
So American forces are spread thin all over the world. Soldiers are doing 6-7 tours on duty in Afghanistan. Air strikes alone will not be enough to overwhelm the Iranian military. We know that. So where are the boots that will win this war for Mr. Bolton?
I think they believe that the, as John Bolton said just the other day, quote, crippling sanctions, unquote, are going to cause so much turmoil, depression of the currency, main items not available to the Iranian people, even food and humanitarian and medical supplies are being impacted. I think they hope that this tension causes a somewhat different Iranian population now than, say, in 2009 during the Green Revolution to rise up and to overthrow the theocracy. That's their best solution, if you will. But I think they also see in the background pressure on Iran and Hezbollah and Iranian agents in Syria, pressure on Iran around the world, pressure on Iran in Iraq, especially southern Iraq, and ultimately perhaps even military action against Iran in company with the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and perhaps even Israel as being ultimately the thing they will turn to if regime change doesn't come about some other way. That's why I liken it to 2002 and 2003. It looks like the same roadmap to me all over again.
So can America afford to deal with Iran and cause instability there if wars in neighboring Iraq and Afghanistan aren't even over yet?
Asking my opinion, absolutely no, we can't. Looking at $22 trillion in debt, looking at an interest payment on that debt that's going to equal the defense budget next year or the next, looking at almost no discretionary federal spending when you put those two things together, the defense budget and the interest payment on the debt, no, we can't afford it. But we seem to have leaders who, like Dick Cheney in 2002, believe that deficits don't matter. Believe that as long as we control the world's transactional currency, its reserve currency, the dollar, we can do anything we want to. And of course, I'm fully aware of the dollarization movement in the world led from Moscow and Beijing. I'm aware of the speech that President Putin made, I believe in Vladivostok recently, and I'm aware of what that might mean ultimately, but I'm in a country whose leaders, by and large, do not seem to understand that, do not seem to understand basic economics and finance. So to answer your question is they think they can afford it.
Well, that, and also Iran enjoys good relations with Russia and China that you've mentioned, who have borders in the region, vital interests there. What kind of reaction will a bombing of other hostile action towards Iran provoke?
I think it'll provoke what is already happening with this president and this administration, and that is a deepening of the isolation of the United States from the rest of the world. If you listen to Federica Mogherini the other day, the foreign affairs representative, as it were, for the European Union, and you listen to the passion in her voice as she, and I've listened to her staff on the telephone and heard their passion, as she detailed how Europe was going to try to avoid U.S. sanctions and still function at least partly with Iran so as to preserve the JCPOA, then you understand how isolated the United States is becoming. That's very dangerous, and I hope we get a new president very soon who has a completely different agenda with regard to the U.S. foreign security policy and its position in the world. Because this isolation we're putting ourselves in, self-isolation, as it were, is not good for us. It's not good for the world either.
Well, he's there at least for two other years. France, Britain, and Germany, as well as Russia and China, are trying to...
You might be wrong. He might not be there for two more years.
Let's just wait and see. Open. Yeah, we never thought he would win, so let's just wait and see. So France, Britain, and Germany, as well as Russia and China, are trying real hard to keep the nuclear deal alive by inventing ways to soften the blow of the United States sanctions for Iran. Former NATO Secretary General Javier Solana believes the EU's efforts are doomed to fail because of the U.S. international financial clout. Do you agree with Solana?
Solana might be right, because what I see in the European Union is a gross domestic product that equals our own. I see 400 million people. I see more money in their banks than in the U.S. and China combined. I see more latent and potential power possibly than any other country in the world, even Russia, China, Japan, the U.S. And yet I see no political cohesion. And so all that power just gets dissipated. They have no political power because they cannot bring Berlin, Paris, London, Brussels, and all the rest together in a political way. So as long as that's the case, I kind of agree with Solana.
So U.S. sanctions targeting Iran's oil exports will come into force in November, and then Trump promises more sanctions, tougher than before. You just said that neoconservatives will use sanctions to pressure Iran, but what makes this administration think that Iran will finally bow down to this pressure and won't go out of the deal with a bang to restart its nuclear program?
I think they think that the tensions in the Iranian population are much greater now, and that it would just take maybe a little bit of a sanction tightening here, there, wherever, and particularly the ones that go into effect the morning of 5 November to do it. I think they're wrong. I think Iran is far more resilient than that. I think you're looking at not quite the ability that Saddam Hussein had, for example, to bust sanctions all the time, to sell his oil on the black market, if not sometimes on the white market. And I think you're looking at Russia and China and most likely India and other countries who will operate on the black and the white market and keep Iran solvent. So I think their expectations in that regard are wrong. So what do they do then? That's my concern. When Iran is able, because of Russia, China, other countries' assistance, maybe even the EU's partial assistance, when Iran is able to stand up to the Boltons and the Pompeos, what do we do then? That's what I'm concerned about.
So I just don't get it. Why is America so hell-bent on fighting Iran for decades and decades now? And I really don't get the reasons for all this anti-Iran sentiment. I mean, nothing stops these two countries from living normally with each other, like it has been under the Shah. And you know, when they used the pretext of terrorism, I was just like, you know, I yet have to see one Shia terrorist blowing up something in Paris, Madrid, London, Brussels, or Berlin. What is this
When you
this
find
all
the
about?
Answer to that question, please email me. Now, please email me. I asked the same question. I did the war planning for the principal force provider command in the United States military for years. I've worked on this region for years. I do not understand this. Saudi Arabia is the greatest state sponsor of terrorism in the world still today, and yet we call Iran that. We lie when we say that. We outright, blatantly lie when we say that. Moreover, we know we're lying. So I don't understand this either. I am as perplexed as you are at this fascination we have for the tyranny in Riyadh and the hatred we have for the theocracy, partial democracy in Tehran. In geopolitical terms, in geostrategic terms, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Iran has helped its neighbor Iraq withstand the onslaught of ISIS. And now the U.S. needs Iranian help in Iraq to stave off future ISIS threats and to stabilize the country. Can Washington confront Iran in some areas and still cooperate in others?
We were doing that. We were doing that even in the second Bush administration. I should say we were doing it majorly in the first Bush administration, particularly in Afghanistan, right after 9/11. We were cooperating with Iran, and Iran was cooperating with us, and the results were pretty positive. Has there been cooperation since? On and off, yes, particularly in the Obama administration, but it's been very limited, very constrained, and has never led to anything. And what the JCPOA diplomacy was supposed to lead to, according to John Kerry and Wendy Sherman and President Obama himself, was a more robust set of talks about everything from banking to finance to fixing Iran's financial system to ballistic missiles and terrorism and you name it. We were going to talk about all those things, and we're going to do it in a diplomatic manner, and we're going to do it basically with diplomats. That was the plan that the JCPOA negotiations would lead to that. Then Donald Trump came in and closed the door completely. I don't think we have talked to Iran substantially since Donald Trump took the oath of office. Again, perplexing. I do not understand that approach.
All right, Colonel Wilkerson, thank you for this interview. We were talking to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, discussing the U.S. Middle East policies. That is it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
Listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.